doesn't match with the past time place that you see here, which is the tree at Kaliyagat. So we'll leave this here so people can come and have a look during the morning. But this little pastime is Krishna and the gopis, and they're giving Krishna so many things to eat. It's termed a forest picnic. So you can come and see. And it's interesting, you can see that a small child immediately comes up and looks in amazement at all sorts of little things and takes them in very easily because they have a very simple, unsophisticated mind. But as we go on in life, we get so many things come into place and fit into the infrastructure of our consciousness, and our mind becomes no longer simple. It becomes many layered, and we have so many concepts and theories and so many important things to do that push us and compel us and so forth. And so then it seems almost to a sophisticated adult mind sort of a childish thing to do, to have a look at some little ornament. But a child will do it. So we can see that in the Bible also Jesus Christ has said that it, like a little child, it's very easy for them to enter into the kingdom of God. And we can see the same thing in bhakti, actually, because I was just talking with my husband and he was commenting that actually it's very difficult to find somebody who develops love of Godhead. And we were reflecting upon how the difficulty is that love of God or love of Krishna is actually extremely simple. And it's a sentiment. The heart has to become overtaken by a sentiment. And generally you see, particularly because we've been traveling for the last month, so we've been in and out of airports and traveling through different countries, so anyone can be represented, any country that you may be coming from, you'll see that the sophistication that is being presented as the modern way of life and the technology and the speed, so that you can sit in your lounge room and you can book your ticket on the flight. And not only can you book your ticket, you can also make your seating arrangements. You can control everything. You come to the airport, you just walk straight through with your briefcase, and you can control the whole thing. And more and more and more sophistication is being forced upon the people of this world, and they accept it as facility. And they relish it, and they live in it, and they identify with it as being reality. And you come to India, and they're doing it here also, and you'll see year by year by year, because money is involved, so they will also take over as much as they can, at least of the cities of India. But when you come to India, you can't hide. You can't hide an accident on the highway. You drive past and you see everything. You can't hide the dead animals that die on the side of the road. You can't hide the ugly facts of life. You can't make it sophisticated. And Srila Prabhupada said this was the glory of India, that you can't create this smooth, demoniac facility that robs everyone of their time and their sentiments. The sentiment, the most precious and subtle and refined sentiment, is to love Krishna. But the complexities of modern life make that seem not the priority. So I was thinking as we were traveling around how unattractive, how repulsive actually this modern setup is, even though it's very easy to get caught up in it and go along with it. But it's actually very, very, very soulless, and it moves at a very, very fast pace. So if you start in on it, then it will keep you like rushing down a river, possibly for the rest of your life, until you get too old or too inconvenienced to be able to keep up with it. And then you have to start questioning, what's the purpose of my life? And then first of all, one has to understand that Krishna's pastimes are the essence of what we're supposed to be developing a taste for. Because we can't get out of the material world so long as we're preoccupied with a false ego. We have to stay in, as we were hearing yesterday, the world of dreams. But it's so real and so strong and so compelling. And we like to give up some part of it, like the distasteful parts. We become repulsed by something and we think, that's awful. I wish that wasn't here. And because of that, that's very bad, and so on and so forth. But we don't want to give up the whole thing. But the whole thing has to actually be released by the living entity. So we have no power to do this. Only Krishna can do this from within the heart. So by the strength of what is still, I say for myself, and I'm sure for most of us will agree, what is still completely hidden from us within the holy name. We chant, mechanically chant, dutifully chant. Sometimes we chant with satisfaction. But we have no, it's like bees swarming around a jar of honey, as Srila Prabhupada explained. You can't get any taste until the honey jar becomes open. But what is within the honey jar? Shri Radhika Madhavayora Para Madhuriya Lila Guna Rupa Nam Nam. Madhuriya Lila Guna Rupa and Nam. These are the four specialities that a liberated soul and exalted devotee is always preoccupied within. And I find for myself, and again I think I'd be speaking for all of us, that the quality of my concentration or my absorption in pastimes or the holy name or even studying Shastra leaves an awful lot to be desired. It's not strong enough that it totally overpowers all my senses. And when I'm asleep at night, I'm just simply meditating in my subconscious on how to wake up in the morning and hear about Krishna and serve Krishna. And throughout the day, I'm completely, totally focused there, so that there's everything around me, all the material sophistry is just, I'm unnoticed. Like we hear the story, I can't remember the exact story, but it was, I think, of an arrow maker who was making his arrow, his bow with such intensity, and a royal procession passed by down the street, and he didn't see any of it, and everybody else was completely immersed in it. So that quality of concentration and absorption we actually urgently require, because without that, whatever happens, good or bad, on the material, worldly, dream-like stage, will just completely fill us up, and we won't be able to think of anything else. And we'll see, just like when somebody is watching a movie, they're taken over by the sentiments displayed, portrayed by the characters in the story, and they don't think of themselves at that time. They go along with whatever's taking place. So this is how we are at present in terms of our dealings with the material energy. But this has to stop if we want to actually come to the stage of what Srila Prabhupada wanted. He wanted to give us something very tangible, but very heavy. So heavy, because it's in direct contrast to the material world. So knowing that no one can take such a radical shift from this material absorption to absorption in Krishna, so Srila Prabhupada, following the line of our Guru Parampara and inspired by his own transcendental realization, he devised a scheme whereby we could use these things, and by using them we should come step by step by step by step to the point where we can surrender our faculties to Krishna and say, now I've used these things. As I've used these things, I've used the computer and the car and the mobile phone and all the other facilities. I've dedicated these things to your service. Now please, if you could use me, you could consider me like one of those items that I have been attached to and using for you. Please become attached to using me. And please allow me to give up the conception that I have independent rights and controls that bar me, that prohibit me from being used by you. So in Vrindavan, there's not anyone, not from a blade of grass, not from one of the birds in the trees, not from any of the residents of Vrindavan, nobody or nothing, not even the light or the air or the time factor, there's nothing there that is not 100% dedicated to giving Krishna pleasure and nothing else. None of the residents of Vrindavan seek for themselves gratification of their own senses or their own sentiments. They don't want to be happy. This is so difficult for a conditioned soul to understand. And so Srila Prabhupada, so many times he would talk on this level to us, don't try to be happy, don't try to enjoy, don't try to see Krishna. And he would give these prohibitive statements that I remember for myself sometimes left me with a feeling that Krishna consciousness was something so restrictive because I couldn't try to enjoy and I wanted to enjoy and I had to follow these things and I didn't enjoy them and it was so difficult. And we see that so many devotees haven't been able to concentrate their whole lives in taking up this process of Krishna consciousness. And at some point or another, they have gone backwards towards developing again, re-attracting or re-acclimatizing themselves to being part and parcel of the material world. And generally speaking, most devotees you meet who have done this, they feel better for having done it. You examine and you'll see, you talk to them and they feel much more comfortable now. It was a strain for them to always be doing these things they didn't really want to do. And sometimes they say, and I felt so phony, but now again I'm on with a career and I'm taking care and I have my place in the world again. And it's such a relief from trying to fight against the material energy. It's too hard. That's as I've done as much as I could do of that, and now I'm doing something else. And going to the West, living in the West, you can see that living there, it's so difficult because other than the atmosphere that you create around you or that you create communally with sometimes a small group of devotees, and then what you create in your house, which means not letting in the material energy in the form of so many ways. We all know the ways that people let the material energy into their household. And so then if you don't create a cocoon practically against the whole of the world going on outside, then you're bound to have the material nature flowing through your environment. And what can you do? It's very, very difficult because you're going to be like an island in the middle of a vast ocean. And everywhere you look, everyone you look at, everything you look at is devoid of a function of trying to help somebody to serve and love Krishna. Everywhere, everything. So this is so heavy. And Srila Prabhupada says in Bhagavad Gita, that to take up Krishna consciousness more or less means to declare war on the illusory energy. And anyone who has ever watched a war movie or read articles about war means that it's so terrifying, practically speaking, it's terrifying to declare war. But this is what Srila Prabhupada came for. That's why sometimes he's known, people call him affectionately in their own terms, that like he's like a general. And perhaps even he himself would use such a term. Because he came to declare war single-handedly, particularly in the West, which is it's actually a most amazing thing. If you go back to wherever you've come from and you look around and you think, if you had to go there single-handed, all by yourself, and try to convert hundreds and hundreds of people to accept Krishna bhakti. Now, most people have at least a few other devotees, if not a temple, if not a community, to take shelter of. But if you were to go there and try to convert all the concepts that Srila Prabhupada has changed and introduced into culture and society all over the world, no human being could do it. Only somebody who was greatly empowered, and that this was his service to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, to bring the Maha Mantra and plant it in the infertile, barren, lackluster soils of the Western countries, which are full of all kinds of artificial things. So Srila Prabhupada, he came and he did this, and he asks us to perpetuate the struggle that's involved in being Krishna conscious. But part of that has to be, if we want to remain strong, we have to come to the holy dharms. And we have to come here because when we come here, the processes required in devotional growth are reversed. In the West, if you want to be a good devotee, if you're serious, you have to always be holding back from everything. You have to be controlling your senses, keeping your senses in. To the degree that you let them out and run free, they will pick up on rubbish. Granted, guaranteed, they'll pick only rubbish. Of course, if somebody is engaged in service, then that is the form of control. And so it's not so that we have to only be restrictive. We can be very enthusiastic devotionally. But in terms of dealing with the material energy itself, we have to always be restrained. But when we come to the Dharma, we have to reverse that cycle. And we have to come here and we have to learn how to open up. And we have to learn how to take in as much as we can, just take it in. And we have to learn how to feel safe. Of course, this doesn't mean that we should become indiscriminate or we should just wander here and there in an arbitrary way. But hearing and chanting about the pastimes of Krishna in the Dham is so different than doing that in the Western atmosphere, that when we come, particularly in a yatra, or for study purposes, or to serve here in the Dham, we make so much advancement on the positive side. We can make, as I said, by preaching in the West, there's such a taste, because Srila Prabhupada was so much adamant that this was his particular desire, following in the mood and desire of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, and prior to that, to the mood of Srila Bhakti Vinod Thakur, who predicted that there would be one church, one religion, one book all over the world, one mantra. Following the mood of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself, who said that my name will be chanted in every town and every village, from the side, from the bank of every river to the shore of every ocean, my name will be chanted. So we cannot see this yet, but we heard last night from the Chaitanya Leela that before Mahaprabhu was ready to start his Sankirtan movement, the devotees were all thinking, if Nimai Pandit would become a devotee, it would be so good for us, because he's so powerful, but he's not interested in devotional things. In fact, practically speaking, he breaks our heart, because whenever we meet him, we think he's so wonderful, but all he wants to do is challenge us on the principles of grammar. He wants to ask us some grammatical questions and logical questions, and then when we answer him, they tried to avoid him. One fellow student, Mukunda, he was going down the street and he saw Mahaprabhu, Nimai Pandit, coming towards him. And he quickly diverted his course and went down another path, off to the side, to avoid him, and walked around because he thought, oh no, here comes Nimai Pandit and he's so arrogant. He's so proud. He's going to just catch me and ask me so many things. And Mahaprabhu, inwardly, Nimai Pandit, Mahaprabhu was so pleased to see the mood of Mukunda. But he said in a very arrogant external way, he said, look at Mukunda. He thinks he's such a great devotee that he's trying to avoid dealing with me. But I'll show him. I one day will become such a great devotee that even Lord Brahma and even Lord Shiva will come and they'll all bow down to me. So even in that condition of intellectual arrogance, Mahaprabhu arrogantly was saying, and you just wait and see what kind of a devotee I can be. So this was the fact. So he has said, my name will be sung everywhere, so we should have no doubt on that, that this will come. And if it hasn't come yet, and in fact quite the opposite is taking place, the Ugra Karma is just spreading at the most phenomenal speed. The grossities of life and the sophistications of life are completely out of control. We should be certain that all of these things are not out of the plan of Mahaprabhu, and none of these things are independent. None of them can function in the way they do without Krishna's desire for them to be there, but that they haven't manifest their true purpose yet until Mahaprabhu's Sankirtan movement is established worldwide on a very intense level. So the tree that we're talking about today is at Kaliyagat. And Kaliyagat, this tree, is actually so old. When you go back to Vrindavan, you should go and take darshan of this tree. It's so old, it's inconceivably old. This tree dates back to the Satya Yuga, because many, many, many hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years ago, when Garuda was passing by this tree, he had one cup, and in that cup he had this nectar of immortality that the demigods are always seeking for, and that the ocean of milk was churned for, and that Rahu managed to get one mouthful of, and then he lost his body, but his head became immortal as a planet. This immortal nectar of the demigods, one drop Garuda dropped upon this tree when crossing over Vrindavan in Braj, and therefore this tree has remained. So the story was that long ago in the Satya Yuga, Kasyapa Muni, who had many, many wives, had two wives. One, her name was Kadru, and the other one's name was Vinita. And Kadru was very argumentative. She was quite proud. And Vinita was more gentle and shy. So Kadru was somehow or other jealous of Vinita. And Vinita had one son. Her son was Garuda. And the son of Kadru was Kaliya. So Kadru, one day, she said to her co-wife, she was sitting outside with her, she was looking up into the sky, and she said, can you see the chariot of the sun god? And she was looking, she could see. She had the ability to see. And she said to her co-wife, she said, what color are the tails of the horses who are driving the sun god's chariot? And Vinita, she knew the nature of her co-wife. So she was looking. And her co-wife said, you should tell me if they're black or if they're white. And if you're right, then I'll become your maidservant for the rest of my life. But if you make the wrong choice, if you make a mistake, then you'll become my maidservant for the rest of your life. So Kadru and Vinita were sitting there, and Kadru indicated to Kaliya. So Kaliya flew up into the sky, and he covered the tails of the horses of the sun god's chariot with his own body, because he had so many hoods and heads. And so then Vinita said, the tails of the sun god's horses are black. And then Kaliya, he moved aside, and Kadru said, no, they're not. You see, they're white. So now you become my maidservant for the rest of your life. So Vinita, she was very unhappy. And she served Kadru, but she wasn't at all pleased to be in this situation. And she didn't speak anything to anyone. She went on serving, and Kadru was very proud. And as Garuda grew to maturity, he noticed that his mother was always sad. Even though she was going about her activities, there was something about her that was very unhappy. So one day he took his mother aside and he asked his mother, "Why are you always so sad? What is the difficulty?" So then his mother revealed to him the situation, what had taken place. So Garuda then he went confidentially to Kadru, and he said to Kadru, "Is there anything I could give you that would allow you to release my mother from having to serve you in this way?" So Kadru thought, and she thought. And then she said, "Yes, there is something that you could give me. I would like the nectar of immortality from the heavenly planets. If you can get that nectar, which is very, very difficult to get, it's only reserved for the exalted demigods. If you can get that nectar and bring it here, then I will free your mother from this situation." So Garuda immediately left for the heavenly planets, and he got that nectar. And he brought it back, and as I said, on the way back, he dropped one drop on this tree, so that the tree became, literally, practically speaking, like immortal. And then he proceeded on, and he gave this to Kadru, and Kadru released Vinita from this particular situation. But there was always conflict between Garuda and Kaliya. Just by nature, their natures were different. Garuda was so sattvic, he becomes also the equal carrier of Lord Vishnu himself. Whereas Kaliya, he was by nature passionate and envious. He had the nature of a snake. And later, when he approaches to pray to Krishna, he admits this himself. We read in the Bhagavatam that he says, "What can I do? I have this envious nature. How can I be any different? So please forgive me for what I have done." So Kaliya, he went to live on an island, and there he was the king of many, many snakes. And Garuda, because it's the food of eagles to eat snakes, he used to go there and eat the snakes. And so then it was arranged that a sacrifice should be made for Garuda so that he would be satisfied and he wouldn't harass all of the snakes. But Kaliya, in his envy, he ate the sacrifice that was meant for Garuda. And so then Garuda became very angry with Kaliya, and he started to chase him, and he was going to kill him. So Kaliya fled from this island where he was living, and he took shelter in the Jamuna River. He took shelter in a place called Kaliya Hridha. Hridha, I don't know the exact Sanskrit pronunciation, but it means like a lake within a river where there's some area that has become like a lake. So this deep lake area was where Kaliya went immediately. Now, this story is so interesting. This pastime is so full of meaning, because there was a reason why Kaliya went there. He went there because he knew that Garuda couldn't go there, and therefore he was safe there. But the question should be asked, why couldn't Garuda go there? Why didn't Garuda ever go to that particular place? And the answer was that there was one yogi, a mystic yogi, and he was meditating under the water. So he was not a bhakta. He was not a devotee. He was a yogi. And he was practicing to meditate and meditate and concentrate and fix his mind. And his austerity was to remain under the deep waters of the Jamuna. So under the water there, practicing his yoga and his austerity, he became, because Srila Prabhupada explains, it's natural. We are social animals by nature. He became very much attached to the fish, Just like if somebody becomes very unfortunate, their children die or leave them and they have no grandchildren, then they sometimes get a cat. And they're always with their cat. And everything, all their affection, they dedicate to the cat. Now, he's a yogi, so he's not supposed to be doing that. He's under there supposed to be meditating and controlling his senses. But because of the very nature of the human being, he became attached to the fish. And Garuda at this time, this was prior to Kaliya's going there, Garuda used to go there also. So one day Garuda came there and he ate some fish. And Subari Muni thought, this is difficult, I should protect the fish. So he went and spoke on behalf of the fish he was trying to protect. And he asked Garuda, please, not to take the fish. But then Garuda came just indifferently to Subari Muni, and he took one fish. But the one fish that he took was the leader of all the fish, the biggest fish. He took that fish and he just swooped him up and went away. And when Subari Muni saw this, he felt so much for the fish. He wanted to protect the fish. He became so offended on behalf of the fish that he made a curse that if Garuda comes here again and harms these fish, if he comes here and does this again, then I guarantee that he will die. So he thought that he was doing something to help the fish in his limited understanding. And because he was not a devotee, he was thinking in this very small way. And so by doing this, by making this curse on Garuda, he committed three offenses. The acharyas explain he did three very foolish things. One was that he offended a Vaishnava, because you can't curse a Vaishnava, but he did. He cursed him. So he cursed Garuda. The second one was that he offended not only a Vaishnava, as well as a Vaishnava. Garuda is the eagle carrier. He's the carrier of Lord Vishnu. So what right did he have to offend Garuda? He's beyond anyone's approach. And the third thing that he did wrong was, of course, that he took the side of the fish. So what was the result of this? Three things. The first thing was that the insidious Kaliya, who was far more dangerous than Garuda, he took up residence in the place of the fish. And Kaliya didn't eat the fish, but what he did was he spread his poison. And he spread poison everywhere. And as he spread his poisonous fumes and his poisonous gases all over the Jamuna, all the fish died. So that was the first thing. So the first thing was that Kaliya came. The second thing was that the fish that he was trying to protect, they were all destroyed, not by Garuda, but by Kaliya. They all were in greater difficulty for his trying to protect them than they would have been if Garuda had appeared. And the third thing was, what happened to Subari Muni? What was the effect of his offenses? And this is very sobering, because it's not so easy to see this. If we said that as a result of his offenses, Subari Muni was struck dead on the spot, then everyone would shake in their shoes and think, oh, I shouldn't commit offenses to Vaishnavas. But no, that wasn't what took place. What took place was that within the heart of Subari Muni, material desires started to come. And these material desires started to grow. And because of the material desires, before the advent of Kaliya, who came and killed all the fish, before that, one day when Subari Muni was so supposedly doing his meditation, he opened his eyes and he saw before him two fish, a male fish and a female fish, and they were enjoying loving activities together. And when Subari Muni saw the male and the female together, because he had opened his heart by offenses to Vaishnavas, he had opened his heart for material enjoyment to come seeping in. When he saw these two fish together, he became moved by their activities, and he thought to himself, I want a wife. So he got up out of the water. You can imagine what he looked like, having spent hundreds and hundreds of years underwater. You put your hand in the water for an hour, and you see how wrinkled and horrible it looked. So he was so old and so wrinkled, and he got up out of the water, powerful mystic yogi, having performed so much austerity. And he left that place. He left the Jamuna. He left Vrindavan. And he went nearby to a king called Maharaj Mandatta. Mandatta Muni, I think he lived near to Mathura. And he went to him. He walked into the court, and when the king saw him, he knew that, uh-oh. Because the kings, on one hand, they were very respectful to sages and saints, but they were also very, very much aware that especially somebody who was irascible, they could be cursed if they didn't give them what they wanted. So this ugly, wrinkly old yogi, he came to the court of the king. He walked into the court. The king offered all respects to him and asked him, "Please, is there anything I can do to satisfy you? It's my great privilege that you've come to see me." But with great care he was offering, and the yogi said, "Yes, there is something you can do. I want to marry your daughter." Now the king is looking at him. He's so ugly, he's so strange. And he has not only one daughter, he had 50 daughters, and they were exceedingly beautiful princesses. And so the king thought, and he tried to be extremely diplomatic. So he said to the old wrinkly yogi, he said, "You should go and see my daughters. And if my daughter wishes to marry you, then I give my consent that any of my daughters can marry you." So Subari Muni, he was so intelligent because he had mystic power and he knew what the king was doing. And he chuckled to himself and he thought, "This king is thinking that if I go looking like this, all these girls will be repulsed by me." And so by his mystic power, he transformed his body and all of his features until he was so young and so handsome and so exceedingly attractive in a worldly sense that he walked into the chambers, the inner chambers of the princesses, and they very shyly looked from their balconies down upon this beautiful young man who had entered their courtyard. And every one of those 50 princesses became so charmed by him, totally enamored by Subari Muni's features, that they all wanted to marry him. So he married them all, 50 of them, and he expanded to enjoy excessively with every one of them. He enjoyed with them in the most luxurious ways. He enjoyed sex life with them. He enjoyed eating with them. He enjoyed sporting with them. He enjoyed babies and children with them and family life with them. And he had 50%, 50 times more enjoyment than even Indra could imagine. He had so much enjoyment came to him. This was the result of his offense. Can we imagine this? We expect that when somebody commits an offense, they should become maimed or crippled or die or something. They do something heinous. But this is a greater punishment that we should all be aware of. And we should, if we see material desires starting to arise in our hearts, if we feel more affinity for the material nature than we felt before. I remember myself personally having this experience that we were living in Hong Kong. Srila Prabhupada had requested us to start a temple in the very, very early days, in the early 70s, 1970-71. And it was so difficult. And we were so lonely because neither did we have Westerners that we, of course, couldn't enjoy with. But now we were surrounded by Chinese people and the Chinese culture, and it was actually really horrible. And so you just felt so out of place there. We never went into shops. We never talked to people. There was nothing to talk about. They weren't interested in Krishna consciousness, and we weren't interested in anything else. And we couldn't find a bridge to deal with anyone. And then at a certain particular point, we were also influenced, and just because you could say, if nothing else, by being younger devotees, immature devotees, one becomes embroiled in conflicts with other devotees who have hurt them, or who have misunderstood them, or have done some injustice to them. So we became entangled in that way. And as a result of that, material desires started to develop. And it was interesting to see how Krishna dealt with it, because we became much more relaxed with the materialistic people. And on one side, it was very favorable for us for preaching, because we could speak to people in a way we couldn't have done before. We became more comfortable with them. But I remember, even to this day, one time walking through a big fancy department store and stopping to look at everything, looking at the crystal glasses, looking at the clothes, looking at things, dressed now not as a devotee, but in clothes that I had been very comfortable in before, and thinking to myself, boy, I used to feel so uncomfortable going through this place. I wouldn't look at anything. And now, I feel so comfortable here. This is really nice. But little did I understand why I felt so comfortable. And it was later, by Srila Prabhupada's arrangement, where he knew what was going on. So he chose to come and put an end to the maya that had arisen. And so he came personally to Hong Kong. And when he arrived and I was confronted face to face with him, and there he was, large as life and heavy, so heavy. He looked like Lord Nisringadev. He was so powerful and weighty and heavy. And he was standing there and his chin was up and his lips were down and his eyes were full of sternness and he was looking at us. It was only then that I realized very openly, not concealed from myself, that I was in so much maya. I had accommodated so many things and incorporated them into my Krishna consciousness. But the mystery was, inconceivably, Krishna had even used us in that condition. And so there were people who had come, as we see so many times with devotees when they leave, people come to Krishna consciousness through their activities, even when their activities have become degraded. So it had worked in that way. In a mysterious way, on one hand, we had made advancement because we were now preaching to more people than before. And on the other hand, our own personal Krishna consciousness was severely impinged upon by the worldly things that we had been taking in quietly, 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 along with our yukta vairagya attitude. So this happened to Subari Muni big time. 50 times more than anyone else, he was sunk into material life. And he enjoyed for hundreds and hundreds of years like this. But the more he enjoyed, it never quenched his thirst. Just like if you were to drink salty water, it will never quench your thirst. You have a glass of salty water, you finish it, you want more. And if you're handed it, you want water. But somebody gives you more salty water, you drink it, no, 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 I want... So like that, he kept drinking and drinking and drinking the enjoyment of his family and his children and his everything that he had as a result of his possession. And he became more and more and more and more restless inside. And at a certain point, perhaps we could say at the point when he had paid sufficiently for his offense, at a certain point he began to reflect. And he thought, what have I done? I was living under the water in the Jamuna, practicing austerities. Look where I am now. I'm surrounded by materialistic things. What have I done? And he came back to his sense. And he called his wives and he spoke to them. And he told them, he said, I have made such a big mistake. I don't know how this has happened, that I have come to this point, but now I want to change it. I don't want to live like this anymore. I want to leave for the forest, and if you want, you can come with me,
But I want to go to the forest and take up again the lifestyle that somehow or other I lost. And so he left. And then he prayed and prayed. And he became more. This is the mercy of Krishna. By his punishment. Punishment that we would think would be great enjoyment. But it's punishment to become attracted to the material energy. So by that punishment he burnt out his material desires, his offenses, and he became capable of continuing on with his spiritual progress. That was Subari Muni. Meanwhile, Kaliya built a palace, a city. He had a yogi city that he could build, a city of water. Just imagine, a city made out of water. That's called a siddhi, a water city. And he built this city and he lived there under the waters of the Jamuna water, the Jamuna lake. And because he lived there, and the poisonous vapors that came from his thousands of heads and his poison that he was spouting all the time, it came up and it killed all the fish and it made the whole side of the Jamuna completely barren. And the only tree that survived the poison of Kaliya was this tree, because this Kadamba tree had been specially arranged by Garuda for the Lord's pastime. So it remained throughout this whole episode. So then, at the right time, as we know, Krishna and the cowherd boys came, and the boys drank the water of the Jamuna, and they fell down dead. And Krishna then revived them, and he understood what had taken place, what Kaliya was doing. So we might ask, how would the boys wander to the side of the Jamuna looking so ghastly with all of the dead plants and the smell and the fumes? Why would they drink that water? So we can, when we ask the mind, the intellect models a question like that, we should understand that everything in Vrindavan is under the control of Krishna's Leela Shakti and his Yogamaya Shakti. And they arrange everything. And nothing in Vrindavan is like anything anywhere else in the material world. So how the Leela Shakti arranges these things is beyond our power to understand. But by hearing these pastimes, gradually we gain a depth of faith that this is the ultimate level of reality, to hear of Krishna's activities in Vrindavan. So the Leela Shakti arranged this. The boys took the water, they fell down. Krishna saw that they had all died, and with his glance he brought them all back to life. Then he decided to climb up on this one lone Kadamba tree and from that tree to jump into the waters of the Jamuna and chastise Kaliya. So he climbed up on the tree, and just as Sachinandan Swami is telling us the qualities of Krishna, one is that he is an immaculate dresser. So he tightened his belt and fixed his turban before he was about to jump. And then he jumped from this Kadamba tree into the water. And when he jumped into the water, he's just a small boy. But the power when he jumped in the water was like as if a mighty mountain fell and water came up everywhere. And Krishna jumped in the water and then he swam out to Kaliya. And he fought with Kaliya, as we know. He caught Krishna first of all in his hoods, then Krishna released himself. And he even danced on the heads of Kaliya in the most artistic way, that the demigods were astonished and they could not even play a beat that could keep up with the beauty of Krishna's dance. So he danced its dance of death on the head of Kaliya. And Kaliya gradually, as he saw all of his powers being diminished, and he was vomiting, first of all his poison came out, and after the poison came out, then blood came out, then his life air was about to come out. And his queens, his wives, the Nagapatnis, they actually were devotional. So in their minds they were thinking, actually, if Krishna kills our husband and we become widows, it's all right. We don't mind. He's so anti-devotional. But then, Gradually, Kaliya began to understand who it was who was dancing on his head and causing him so much destruction. And then he became repentant. And when his wives recognized this, that our husband now is changing in his heart, then they immediately became before Krishna with their little babies in front of them. And they begged Krishna to please save the life of their husband. So Krishna did that. And Kaliya left that place. And the waters of the Jamuna again flowed free and pure. And the residents of Vrindavan could again take their bath there, and the birds could fly there, and the trees were all restored to their former beauty. So this is the tree, and this is the place. So when you return to Vrindavan, if you have any opportunity, please go to that place and offer your obeisances to that particular tree. And I know what you've come to say.
You know what my favorite song is?
Sorry, Rara Vijaya. So we should all go and take Prasadam. I can take a hint. Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Sri Vrindavan Dham ki jai, Sri Radha Govinda ki jai, Sri Radha Gopinath ki jai, Goa Premanandi, Hari Hari Prabhupada.